Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 12, Chapter 12. The Srimad Bhagavatam summarized. Text number 53. Word meanings. Naishkarmyam, self-realization, being free from the reactions of fruitive work. Api, although, achuta of the infallible Lord, bhava, conception, varjitam, devoid of, na does not, shobhate, look well, jnanam, transcendental knowledge, alam, actually, niranjanam, free from designation, kutaha, where is, punaha, again, shushvat, always, bhadram, uncongenial, ishvare, unto the Lord, na, not, he indeed, arjitam, offered, karma, fruitive work, yet, which is api, even anuttamam, unsurpassed. Naishkarmyam apyachyuta bhava varjitam. Na shobhate jnanam alam niranjanam. Kuta puna shashvara bhadramishvare. Nahyarpitam karma tarapyanuttamam. Naishkarmyam apyachyuta bhava varjitam. Na shobhate jnanam alam niranjanam. Kuta puna shashvara bhadramishvare. Nahyarpitam karma rarapyanuttamam. Naishkarmyam apyachyuta bhava varjitam. Na shobhate jnanam alam niranjanam. Kuta puna shashvara bhadramishvare. Nahyarpitam karma yadapyapnuttamam.
Kuta puna shashvara bhadram ishvare.
Kuta puna shashvara bhadram ishvare.
Translation: knowledge of self-realization, even though free from all material affinity, does not look well if devoid of a conception of the infallible, God. What then is the use of even the most properly performed fruitive activities, which are naturally painful from the very beginning and transient by nature, if they are not utilized for the devotional service of the Lord? Purport: this and the previous two verses are found in a slightly different form in the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, 1:5, 10-12. The translations are based on Srila Prabhupada. Om Jnanatimirantasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Shripshuran Militam Mena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. We have some repetition of verses in the Bhagavatam here, and there are a few others at the end of the Bhagavatam, important verses being repeated by Suta Goswami. Suta Goswami, of course, is the main narrator of the Bhagavatam from the first canto all the way through the 12th canto. Sukadeva and Parikshit Maharaj have stepped off the stage at this point, and Suta Goswami is wrapping things up. So this verse, Naishkaryam Apyachita Bhava Varjitam, this is text number 1512. So the fifth chapter of the first canto is Narada's instructions to Vyasadeva. Remember that Vyasadeva was feeling dejected, so Narada appeared on the scene and instructed him. So this is in the context of that. This is early in his instructions, before Narada tells the whole story of his own life. He gets right to the point and instructs Vyasadeva, points out what his problem is. So I'm going to read through the prophet's purport to the verse as it appears in the first canto. It's the same, basically, except the last line. There it's nacharpitam karma yadapya karanam. And here it's yadapya nuttamam. So basically the same. So the purport, through the Prabhupada's purport to that verse: as referred to above, not only ordinary literatures devoid of transcendental glorification of the Lord are condemned, but also Vedic literatures and speculation on the subject of impersonal Brahman when they are devoid of devotional service. When speculation on the impersonal Brahman is condemned on the above ground, then what to speak of ordinary fruitive work, which is not meant to fulfill the aim of devotional service? Such speculative knowledge and fruitive work cannot lead one to the goal of perfection. Fruitive work, in which almost all people in general are engaged, is always painful, either in the beginning or at the end. It can be fruitful only when made subservient to the devotional service of the Lord. In the Bhagavad Gita also it is confirmed that unless the results of such fruitive work are offered for the service of the Lord, they lead to material bondage. The bona fide enjoyer of the fruitive work is the personality of Godhead. And thus, when the results of such work are engaged for the sense gratification of the living beings, those results become acute sources of trouble for such false enjoyers. This verse begins with the word naishkarmyam. Naishkarmyam means, as it translated here, self-realization, being freed from the reactions of fruitive work. So the word doesn't literally mean self-realization. That would probably be something like atma-jnana, knowledge of the self. But naishkarmya means free from karma, I can say. Free from fruitive work, either in the sense of not doing any, or doing it in such a way that you don't get any reaction. Those, the mumukshu bees, those who are trying for liberation, they understand the principle that karma has karmic reactions. We use the word karma for both, actually. Both the work itself and for the reaction, and for the whole system. We use the one word karma for all of these things. So transcendentalists, they understand this point, that as long as you're performing activity, there's going to be reactions to that. So they try to stop it all. And traditionally, of course, they would engage in meditation, or maybe studying Vedanta. Apparently that's not considered work because you're hearing Shastra. So anyway, the idea is to stop physical activity, even mental activity, ultimately. And that becomes self-realization. So here it's said that naishkarmyam api, in spite of, achuta bhava varjitam, or devoid of, varjitam also means devoid of. Api is translated here by Prabhupada as in spite of. And varjitam, devoid of. In spite of being supposedly self-realized, you are achuta bhava varjitam. The person who supposedly self-realized is devoid of achuta bhava. Here bhava doesn't mean bhava. Bhava has quite a few different meanings according to the context. So here it says conception of. So basically, if you're not Krishna conscious, if you're not thinking of achuta, if your naishkarmya is not in relationship to the Supreme Lord, then narshobate doesn't look well. You can say also it's not beautiful, it's not attractive, or it's not desirable. Something that's attractive is desirable. So it's not actually desirable, even though it's actually a step up from karma. So actually the point of this verse is not really to decry naishkarmya, it's to decry karma, fruitive work. This is the whole context of these verses. When Narada begins instructing Vyasadeva, what does he ask him? The first thing he says, are you satisfied with having, I don't know if it says mind, I think maybe, in body and mind as the objects of self-realization? So why does he say that? Well, basically he elaborates by saying, because all the literature that you've given, most of it at least, it's been full of just karma. What's karma about? Karma, in the good sense, fruitive work for elevation to the heavenly planets and getting good results in this world. So is that really what the Vedas should be about? But that's what you've written. So are you satisfied with that? No, you're not satisfied. That's why you're not satisfied. Because that's pretty much what you've done. And we know that. So what Narada is decrying here in this section of verses is karma, fruitive work. You won't get anything valuable from that. But you, Vyasadeva, that's pretty much all you've done. Really, Narada, I always find this to be quite interesting how heavy, you could say, Narada is on Vyasadeva. Because he's written all these Vedic literatures, which of course are meant for the upliftment of human society. But Narada, throughout the Bhagavatam, we see Narada, he goes right to the point, doesn't he? He doesn't mess around. He always preaches renunciation, just like the trouble he got in with Daksha, because he preached to his sons, who actually had some service to do. They were supposed to create progeny. But Narada, he's sort of one of these traveling sannyasis, he just makes problems everywhere he goes. So we see that he's a heavy preacher, Narada is, because he's a Naishtika Brahmachari, so you can expect it, right? That's also his mission in life. He's in, you know, the different, in the beginning of creation, different personalities are Shaktyavesh, because they have certain Shaktis, just like the four Kumaras, they have Jnana Shakti. In Daksha, you can say he has Karma Shakti, but Narada, he has Bhakti Shakti. That's what he's infused with. So that's what comes out of him. He can't help it, you can say. He's programmed for that. So he always gets right to the point. So he's doing this here. Now in a later verse, he talks about the things that Vyasadeva has written as Jugupsitam.
Yeah.
Now this word, Jugupsitam, is really a heavy word. Actually. It means abominable, it means despicable, it means heinous. It comes up later when, in the beginning of the 7th chapter, the first canto, we begin the narration, the story, after the battle of Kurukshetra. So Ashwatthama, he performs the heinous act of killing the 5 sons of the Pandavas. So the same word is used there, Jugupsitam. The same word for Vyasadeva writing the Vedas is used for Ashwatthama killing the sons of the Pandavas. So now he's really not pulling any punches here. He's really being heavy with Vyasadeva, actually. So this is the point that he's making, that it's not really helpful. Of course, what does he say? He says, you told people that they can engage in sense gratification if they follow the rules. But they'll engage in sense gratification and not follow the rules. They'll take advantage because this is the human tendency. We try to get away with as much as we can. Even devotees sometimes do that kind of thing. Someone was mentioning recently, someone asked them, a new devotee said, can I, when in kirtan, can I use my beads and, you know, count the the mantras? So I, you know, that's part of my 16 rounds during the kirtan, the finger in my beard, my beads. And I remember this person, he was crazy. Actually, he was given the name Jadabara because he was a little, anyway, of course, Jadabara, it was just a show, but he was given this name. So he used to chant with 2 bead bags, one in each hand. So he, you know, he had to chant 8 rounds. Well, he said, well, it's 16 rounds. He used them both hands. So but sometimes we think, it's just like with eating, how far can I go with what I eat? And it's still Krishna conscious. So we have this tendency. So Narada is telling Vyasadeva, people have this tendency, they'll do as much as they can. And then, of course, they'll go over the line. This in Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary, maybe that verse, I think, that Jugupsitam verse, or in that this general section of verses, he gives the example of the followers of the Vedas who they use Vedic sacrifice as an excuse to eat meat. They actually wanted to taste meat. They wanted to eat meat. So they justified it. Because in the Vedic sacrifice, you have to kill the animal. So there are certain times when this is allowed, but they went way overboard, we know. And then Lord Buddha had to come to try to put an end to it. Well, this is the tendency. If you're engaged in karma, this tends to be what you do, how much you can get away with. Because the purification is not so intense, you can say. There's some advancement. Prabhupada would say that even by performing karma, especially if you follow the rituals of the Vedas, there's some purification that takes place. But it's very gradual, it's very slow. It's not like Harinam Sankirtan, it's not like chanting the holy names of the Lord. So Narada is telling Vyasadeva. So in the context of that, this verse comes, where he says, not only is that not good karma, maybe if I hope I've convinced you that just the karma is not good, but even naishkarmya, nashobate, is not good. Even that's not attractive. So Prabhupada writes about that in his purport. So we find a lot actually about what is naishkarmya. We have other words like mukti and moksha. Both of these words are used, mukti and moksha. And I find that a lot of times it's hard, I've mentioned this before, what liberation is being talked about here? Even when Lord Chaitanya is talking with Haridas Thakur, there's some mention about, you know, liberating the whole universe. What does that mean? Is everybody going back to Vaikuntha? Or it's not really clarified exactly what it means. So in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, there's some discussion. It's very interesting. You know, what happens, this general story as that unfolds in Brihad Bhagavatamrita, especially the second part. Actually, in the first part, it's Narada Muni is going around to see who got the most mercy. So what happens is one devotee gets glorified, so Narada Muni goes to see him. So when he sees that devotee says, no, 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 don't say that about me. I'm just a rascal. You need to go to this person. So he sends him to someone a step up, you might say. So that person does the same thing. Oh, I'm just a nonsense. Look how I offended Krishna and so on. I really haven't gotten any mercy. Send him to the next person. So that's how it progresses in the first part of the Brihad Bhagavatamrita. And in the second one, you have Gopakumar, who's also traveling around, going higher and higher. And what happens with him is he tends to hear somehow about the next place. So when he hears Lord Brahma, then he heard about somebody who had achieved liberation. So actually what happens usually when Gopakumar gets to some place, he says, wow, I've made it. This is it. This is really amazing. This is ecstatic. But then after a little while, he kind of starts feeling uncomfortable. And because by nature, he's a Gopa. He's a devotee of Krishna. And in that rasa. So he feels uncomfortable. But then he doesn't know anything. You know, it's part of the way Sanatana Goswami describes the story, because a lot of times you think, well, how could he not know this? But he doesn't know somehow. He doesn't seem to know anything. He just learns as he goes along. So he's never heard of liberation. So he hears about liberation and he wants to know what it's about. And there's a whole discussion that goes on there, very interesting, where the different Vedas are actually having debate. So the Bhakti Shastris, at one point, because they're talking about liberation, the Bhakti Shastris, they don't even want to hear about it. And there are certain agamas, which means subsequent Vedic literature. So they also they have some bhakti tendencies. They favor bhakti, and also they don't like to hear about it. But Gopakumar brings them back, and he starts talking with them. So one of the question that comes up is, what actually is mukti? What is mukti? That's really what, of course, Gopakumar wants to know. So there's a verse here that gives three definitions of what moksha is, liberation. This is from Brihad Bhagavatamrita. This is, let's see, the second part, chapter 2, verse 176. Moksha, liberation, is the removal of all misery, or the stopping of illusory activities, or the self-realization that comes from abandoning the false identities created by Maya. For the commentary, these three alternative definitions of moksha, taken from various shastras, are adhered to by those who strive for liberation. So here, now we're going to have a description of what they are again. The logicians of Gautama's Nyaya school hold that liberation is the removal of all kinds of misery. Now is it here? Which they count as 21. So we have threefold miseries, but they have 21 of them. They have more subcategories. Actually, that's also a low number, isn't it? I think I have more than 21 myself. Now, the commentary continues, as the followers of Gautam say, so Gautam is the acharya of the Nyaya school. Now, by the way, we, even Vedanta, we take advantage of these other schools, Purva, Mimamsa, Nyaya, and Sankhya, and so on. But we kind of pick and choose our acharyas. They take what's useful. This comes out in Jiva Goswami's Tattvasandarbha. He discusses this. Especially Purva, Mimamsa. Purva, Mimamsa, that Jaimini Rishi, they set up the system for how you study. You might say the epistemology of studying, or the system. Hermeneutics is actually the word. How you study the Vedas. So there's all these different rules on how you do it. Like, how do you find out what is the text about? There's six different principles that you look for. So you can try to, so that you know what is the author trying to get across. So we use these things, even our Vaishnava Acharyas, and even Vyasadeva in his Vedanta Sutras. So again, as the followers of Gautam say, Atyantiki dukkha nivritti mukti. Liberation is the complete stoppage of suffering. Some of you may be familiar with this phrase, Atyantiki dukkha nivritti, because Srila Prabhupada would quote it. So it's interesting, because essentially Prabhupada is saying these philosophers, they want Atyantiki dukkha nivritti, which means the cessation of all desires. How did you only get that in Krishna consciousness? Prabhupada would quote the phrase, and he wouldn't give the source, but This is called an allusion. Allusion means he's actually alluding to this, the philosophy of the Nyaya school, without actually crediting them with this phrase. So this is the first one of these three kinds of mukti. Atyantiki dukkha nivritti mukti. Mukti, or liberation, is the complete stoppage of suffering. Now, another way Prabhupada alluded to this, he would sometimes say, of course, we want ananda, we want rasa ananda with Krishna. But Prabhupada does point out, I know at least in one place, I remember, where he says, if you just realize the self, then what a great relief that is. That's also a kind of happiness, because I don't have to worry about dying. That fear goes away. Because we're always afraid, we're always in anxiety about this or that. So we have that fear goes away, and mental, both the fear of physical harm and the mental anxiety. So it's kind of nice. So all suffering, when these 21 different kinds of suffering stop, then that's a desirable position, it would seem. So especially the impersonalists, they think, well, that's it. In one form, the Gautam's Nyaya, they think that's all we want, is the suffering to stop. Of course, this is a reaction. The term reactionary tends to be a negative term, because reactionary is also often kind of a knee-jerk reaction where you don't really think about it. You're trying to solve some problem, and just the first thing that pops in your mind, then you're all in favor of that. This happens a lot today in modern time, and people have knee-jerk reactions to problems and they don't really think about the consequences. So the same thing with liberation. Like, I just want the suffering to stop. That's all. I just want the suffering to stop. And you don't, just like if a person's really sick, they don't even think about life after being well again. They just want the suffering to stop. Just give me something to stop the pain. So that's sort of what the Gautama's Nyaya is proposing. They'll just stop the pain. That's it. That's the goal. So that's called moksha. So going back to this verse, Nishobhate, for the devotees, that's not really attractive, just stopping the pain. We want more than that. We want to go to Krishna. That's so much higher. And continuing with this commentary, a section of the Vedanta school says that liberation is the ceasing of illusion and thus activity. So this is going back to this general idea of naishkarmya. You stop activity. You stop because you know that activity is, if it's engaged in an illusion, the illusion that I'm this body, this is the self, this material world, this is everything. If that's the way I'm thinking, well, that's good. That's not beneficial, ultimately. So to cease, that's a kind of liberation. You give up that illusion, and then you stop your activities. You're liberated. Then you're liberated from the karma, of course. So that's naishkarmya. So then the third definition of moksha is, and another party of impersonal Vedantists, the illusionists, Vivarta bodies. Vivarta means illusion. They're called, in other words, they think everything is illusion. They're Vivarta bodies. Just like where we say Maya bodies, which is basically a synonym. So this is the third time. They define liberation as rejecting the false identity produced by the power of illusion and thus really realizing oneself to be one with Brahman. So they want to go to Aham Brahmasmi. Or Tattvam Asi. They have slogans like this. Soham. You are that, and I am Brahman. It's interesting that Prabhupada would quote this, Aham Brahmasmi. And we also, devotees, it's one of the things, one of the first Sanskrit phrases anybody learns in Krishna consciousness practically is Aham Brahmasmi. Brahmasmi. But it's actually something the impersonalists tend to use, because they think, literally, I am Brahman, all of that. What is Brahman? Brahman is the totality of existence. Brihati, there's a definition that comes from one of the Sanskrit dictionaries, Nirupti, I think. It defines Brahman as the greatest thing. In other words, what is the greatest thing? Well, it's everything. So that's Brahman. So the impersonalists think Aham Brahmasmi means I am that. Tattvamasi, which also says that. Of course, that very phrase has Tat and Tvam has two different. You have two in the phrase itself has two, you and that. So, of course, we don't see it that way, that you just become one. But this is their idea. Become one with Brahman. Now, Prabhupada described this as a kind of spiritual suicide because you give up your individual identity and you merge into it. Of course, we know that that's not possible. As we learn in the... We were just hearing this morning, actually. The second chapter, the 10th canto, is the prayers by the demigods to Lord Krishna within the womb. So they speak this famous verse, Yinye Rivindakshami Muktamaninas Toyastabhava Vishuddha Buddhaya. So that you actually fall down from that position of so-called self-realization or liberation, so-called liberation, if you're not attached to the lotus feet of Krishna. It seems to me, this verse it seems to be going to be taken in different ways, because whether you're actually in Brahman and then you fall from it seems to be a question to me, at least. So vimuktamani, that's maybe... be that you think you're liberated, but actually you're not really liberated. Of course, it does say parampadam, which means the supreme destination. But you don't actually get that supreme destination until you're established in the lotus feet of Krishna. In other words, you're not actually liberated. Vimuktamaninas. You just think you're liberated. So we don't see this either as something attractive. If it's temporary, Prabhupada defined it also Brahman. Merging in Brahman is also a fallen condition. When it was asked, well, do we fall from Brahman, from Brahma Jyoti? Prabhupada said, that's already a fallen condition. Because the not fallen condition is to be in the association of Krishna. Of course, Krishna himself is not fallen. Achyuta. And we had that word here in this verse. Achyuta Bhava. So Achyuta means infallible. He doesn't fall. This word is translated in different ways. Of course, we can say, of course, Krishna, how could he fall? Because where's he going to fall from? Everything is him. But generally it's applied to his relationship with his devotees. Achyuta means he does infallible. Prabhupada would say it infallible. Of course, we say infallible. But Prabhupada would pronounce it infallible, which is nice because you get the sense of infall. You don't fall. Infallible means you don't fall. So he doesn't fall from his position from serving his devotees or responding to his devotees. From his loving his devotees and doing everything for them. Really, Krishna's infallible in that sense. For the devotees, he's always there. Rakshishyatiti visvaso duktute varanam tata. One of the six principles of surrender is to know that Krishna will always protect us, and that Krishna, it's another one is that Krishna is the provider. So he'll protect us and he'll provide for us. So he won't fail in that. Yoga kshema bahamyaham. You know this verse where Krishna says, I carry what they lack and preserve what they have. Now devotees like to apply this, they think, well, if I just try, then Krishna's going to take me back to Godhead because he's going to carry what I lack. But the commentary doesn't actually present it that way. The commentary is that Krishna provides the material needs of the pure devotee. That's the way the acharyas present this verse. You don't have to worry about your maintenance, which is, of course, another point that Prabhupada would make repeatedly. That if you just serve Krishna, then you don't have to do this karma. You don't have to do anything else. You just serve Krishna and he will supply everything. So he's also infallible in that for the pure devotee. The pure devotee doesn't have to worry about everything. Krishna will provide for him. So this is our, where we don't see much, and we don't see this liberation as something attractive. Nashobate. It's not attractive to what to speak of ordinary karma. We just stay stuck in this world, going up and down, up and down. But this is what the hardcore karmis, this is their goal, actually. They don't, liberation is not something they even think about. Their idea is that, well, we're just here eternally in this material world. There's no way out. Don't even think about it. There is no out. This is just it. And so do the best you can. Try to get, the top bunk in your prison cell and, be happy with that. And what happens, of course, you're going to go up and then you're going to have to come back down. But when you come back down, then just try harder. And if you really try hard and you perfect your karma, you follow the Vedas, of course, their idea, the karma Jaimini and the karma Mimamsa philosophy is that everything in the Vedas should be taken as injunctive. Injunctive means it's all about rules. You have to interpret everything in that way. Even if it seems to be talking about moksha or bhakti, that's not really what it's about. You're not understanding, actually. It's all about following the rules so that you have good karma, so that you can be elevated to a higher plane. And if you do all those rules exactly right within the Varnashram system for 100 lifetimes, then you can be Lord Brahma. That's as high as it gets. You can be Lord Brahma if you perform your karma perfectly for 100 births. So just imagine, imagine how difficult that is. We hear like someone like King Nriga, little slip up, which is, it's always an interesting story because it doesn't seem like he did anything wrong. Even. It was just an accident. It wasn't his fault, but still he had to suffer the consequences of it. So we find that this is how karma is. It's so strict. So try to do it right. And then, of course, most people don't do it right, so they suffer in different ways. We hear in the fifth canto of the Bhagavatam how people, of course, they end up in hell, even by mistakes. There are injunctions like that in the Vedas, that if you don't do this right, then you're going to go to hell, and you're going to send your ancestors to hell, too. So that's certainly not an attractive system, is it? Who would be attracted to that if they knew the finer details? Therefore, Krishna tells Arjuna right in the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita, in the second chapter, we're not going to talk about these things. You have to rise above these. Nishtaragunya Bhavarjuna. Give up the Vedic literature, the flowery language of the Vedas. It may be enticing, and people are enticed by it. Oh, beautiful women and these wonderful gardens, and you live forever. They think of it that way, and there are verses that say like that. It's called Artavad. You're told that you're going to live forever, but actually it's just an exaggeration. You're not going to live forever. But it seems like that from your position. So there are these ways that we're enticed to do those things. So people are actually attracted to it. But they may not think so much about the negative side of it. So Vyasadeva is hearing from Narada Muni that maybe, you know, it wasn't such a good idea. Not maybe, Narada is saying, you shouldn't have done this. This is horrible. Which is, you know, for us, we think, well, how could it be? You know, the Vedas certainly have their good side. But again, getting back to this point of Narada, saying, why have people waste their time in this? Just tell them about Krishna. Just tell them about Krishna. And of course, the point got through, because what did Vyasadeva do? He told him about Krishna. What is the Bhagavatam? It's all about Krishna. I've been studying the Krishna Sandarbha recently. And there's a section there where, section of Anuchedas, quite extensive, where Jiva Goswami picks out verses throughout the Bhagavatam that shows that everybody there is talking, all the main speakers, at least of the Bhagavatam, are talking about Krishna. And sometimes it's in a bit of a disguised way. So Jiva Goswami, of course, the genius that he is, he explains why. Why actually Maitreya, he wants to hear about Krishna, not anything else. Maitreya, he only wants to talk about Krishna, not anything else. That's actually what he's talking about. He's talking about Krishna, but in this context. One example is when Vidura asks about Prithu Maharaj, Jiva Goswami explains, I forget, maybe he analyzes the Sanskrit, but he says he actually wants to know about Prithu Maharaj because Prithu Maharaj is an incarnation of Krishna. So he's really asking about Krishna coming or empowering Prithu Maharaj. So he goes through all these kinds of things. Another thing he does, Jiva Goswami, he explains in great detail how in the second canto of the Bhagavatam, of course, Lord Brahma gets darshan of Narayan, it seems like, or the Purusha. The Purusha is not Narayan, but the Vishnus. I'm kind of getting clear on this after a long time, but it seems like that generally the idea is that Narayan is in Vaikuntha, and the Vishnus, when we talk about Vishnus or the Purushas, they're the three Vishnus that we know of. So sometimes this distinction is made. When you talk about Narayan, you're talking about the Lord in Vaikuntha. When you talk about the Purushas, that means Lord Vishnu in this material world. So it's generally understood that the darshan that Lord Brahma had was with Vishnu, one of the Vishnus, like Kshirodakshaya Vishnu. But Jiva Goswami goes to great lengths. He gives like at least a half a dozen arguments, quoting the Bhagavatam, explaining how it was actually Krishna himself who appeared to Lord Brahma. And it is Krishna himself who spoke these four nutshell verses of the Bhagavatam. This is what Jiva Goswami does. In different ways, he points out how Krishna is there. And actually, the whole Bhagavatam is ultimately about Krishna. It is Krishna. We may not be able to see it, but it's clearly there. So who wrote the Bhagavatam, Vyasadeva, after you heard from Narada Muni? So what did Narada Muni tell him? Tell about Krishna. Now, of course, then it comes out very clearly in the beginning of the 10th canto is all about Krishna. The 3rd canto is a couple of chapters directly about Krishna, a little bit in the 1st canto directly about Krishna. Actually, several chapters directly about Krishna in the 1st canto. So Krishna is there, you might say, kind of up front, in front of the stage, revealing himself, and especially in the 10th canto. Because in the beginning of the 10th canto, when Parikshit Maharaj asked Shukadev Goswami to talk about Krishna, he says, now talk about Krishna. Actually uses the word Vishnu, interestingly, because Vishnu is also one of Krishna's names. But he says, talk about him in detail from beginning to end. You've talked about so many other avatars. Gopi Parandam Prabhu says that 30 avatars, there's at least one chapter about 30 different avatars in the Bhagavatam. So all these incarnations of Krishna are discussed. But, at most maybe a few chapters, and not all the details of their life. But when he's asked about Krishna, he says, I want to hear in detail about Krishna. So of course we have the whole 90 chapters about Krishna. And actually, if you add those other chapters of the Bhagavatam, it comes up to, I think it's almost half of the Bhagavatam. One third to a half of the Bhagavatam is directly about Krishna when you include other places where Krishna is spoken of directly. Now, of course, you can include the 11th canto or most of it because we have the Uddhava Gita. So that's Krishna also front and center. He's speaking the Uddhava. What is it, 28 chapters or something like that? The Uddhava Gita, it's so long. So Krishna, of course, is very prominent. So Narada was instructed by Vyasadeva and he carried it out. He carried it out by revealing Krishna directly in the Srimad Bhagavatam. All right, I'll stop here. I'll read the verse again. Naishkarmiyam apyachuta bhava bharjitam Nashobate jnanam alam naranjanam Utapuna shashvara bhadram ishvare Nahyarpitam karma yadapyakar anuttamam. Knowledge of self-realization, even though free from all material affinity, does not look well if devoid of a conception of the infallible God. What then is the use of even the most properly performed fruitive activities, which are naturally painful from the very beginning and transient by nature, if they are not utilized for the devotional service of the Lord? Because that's another whole topic, because naishkarmiya means you're also when you're describing naishkarmiya, you're also decrying jnana, because jnana is part and parcel of naishkarmiya path. So there's another whole side of this, is that you can do karma, but you do it for Krishna. You can do jnana, you do it for Krishna. We're obviously interested in jnana, but bhakti jnana, Krishna jnana, knowledge about Krishna. So that these things can become beautiful, shobhate, when they're connected to Krishna. That's the other side of it. All right, any questions? Many questions. We'll start up here with Pani Bhushan, I believe.
That's for saying Krishna so many times. Sort of a luck, but the verse itself says it does not look well. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking, grammatically, this doesn't sound correct, but it must be correct, because if it looks good, That means external. Just a sure. It looks okay. Looks good. But when it's well, I was thinking that it actually looks ill. That some sickness or disease is in there. And you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah, I won't get into a grammatical explanation, but you can actually use either of those. Generally use good, which is an adjective. Good, which is an adjective. You would normally use an adverb after a verb. But certain words, especially having to do with the senses, they can take adjectives. So generally you would say, we might say it looks good. But look well, that can also be used that way. So I think it's just Prabhupada's choice of words, and the editor said, yeah, this is fine, it's good enough. Not sure if Prabhupada was implying anything. He just meant beautiful. Shobhate really means looks attractive. It's not attractive.
I was saying, meaning that it's a precise choice.
Precise choice, a more precise.
Using the word well indicates that something is unwell. That's an internalization of the practice.
Yeah, it's not. You won't be well if you follow that path. Madhavati?
Couple of comments. In the very end, you were talking about the first verse of 10th canto, where Parikshit Maharaj is asking in detail, Sukhdev Goswami. I was just listening to a lecture, Radha Govinda Maharaj, just a couple of days ago, and he said that verse, that's the only time he said that Maharaj Parikshit actually cuts Sukhdev Goswami. Because he's describing all those in the previous chapter, he's describing all of it. And he actually cuts him off, said, okay, I don't want to hear this anymore. I want to hear about Krishna. Mm-hmm. So he cuts him off, actually.
I just read something with it in the comments. I forget. But yet, also, Sukadeva Goswami, because of that, said now he's ready. Now he's ready to really hear the real stuff.
A quick question is, Narad Muni was there when, I know Vyasadeva was there, but was Narad Muni also there when the Bhagavatam was spoken?
Yeah, they were both there.
Yeah, I thought that's pretty interesting. So much he's in the audience and he's been continuously being praised and it's just such a nice feeling about thinking how what's happening in that assembly. The assembly of Vaishnavas are there, Narad Muni is sitting right there, and he's been continuously being praised of what he has done. I thought that's interesting. Again, about Narad Muni being so heavy about saying that what Vyasadeva has done, it's kind of a little. I can understand the Vedas, because 98% of the Vedas is all Karmakanda, or whatever percent, I don't know what percent, but huge percent is Karmakanda, and then you have Gyanakanda. But the Puranas, first of all, are they really part of the Vedas? And then the Puranas, the Goswamis are continuously, they refer to the Puranas. So much description is given in the Puranas. That it's not given in the Bhagavatam. And the Puranas are used again over and over again by the Goswamis to make their point. So, the other Purana, I understand there's Shiva Purana and there's this Purana and other Puranas, but then how is it the Goswamis so much rely on that, and how is that Narad Muni is condemning Vyasadeva for all the other scriptures, including, I guess, the Puranas.
My first thought is that he's really criticizing him for the Karmakanda section of the Vedas. But you're right, because he has already written the Puranas by this time. In fact, he's also written the Bhagavatam, right? There's two versions of the Bhagavatam. This comes out in the Kapasandarbha. So he apparently a shorter version of the Bhagavatam is there. Because after he wrote the Bhagavatam, he wrote the Mahabharata. After he wrote all the Puranas, he wrote the Mahabharata, and the Mahabharata is mentioned in the context of this discussion also. So,
the Puranas, he wrote the Mahabharata, after the Puranas, then he wrote
I think that's how it comes out. I'm pretty sure. Because I think that's part of the question comes up. That, well, if he already wrote all the Puranas, that means he must have written the Bhagavatam before he wrote the Mahabharata. But the Mahabharata, you know, is mentioned here by Narada Muni. You've written this wonderful work. But, so in any case, it seems like, well, Narada's just saying, you have to write more. It's hard to imagine that he's condemning all the, you know, all the Puranas. And even all the Samhitas, we were hearing Maharaj was quoting from, reading from Garga Samhita the other day. So it has so much Krishna Leela is there. Now the Harivamsa, I don't know when that came out. That's considered a supplement to the Mahabharata. And that's all about Krishna. And it's also quite extensive. I didn't realize it. It's you know, several cantos. So, yeah, sometimes... One thing I've discovered is that looking at the details too closely, sometimes you can miss the main point. You almost have to just... Well, don't worry about that. Don't worry about that. Just what is the message that's being presented here? So Narada Muni... You know, maybe Vyasadeva would say, well, what about this? I wrote this. Wasn't that all right? But he's not going to respond like that. He's going to fold his hands and say, yes, I accept your order. What you say is true. I'm going to write all about Krishna. He's taking it in that sense, it seems like. So we can overthink things. I definitely have a problem with that myself. So in the back, Tivikram Prabhu.
I was thinking that not everyone is in the readiness for the Bhagavatam, and so the other literatures would accommodate them, like those in the mode of ignorance and passion and so forth. They might not be ready for Bhagavatam, and so the other literatures that Vyasadeva wrote would be beneficial for them. I mean, I was thinking like
that. Yeah, well, that's our general description that Vyasadeva wrote for everyone. He wrote the Vedic literature. Nigama kalpataroa galitam phalam. The Vedas are like a tree, so there's fruit, all different kinds of fruit on that tree for different kinds of people. But if you want the ripe fruit, then you have to get to the top, and you really should be nimatsaranam. You should be free from envy, and so a certain qualification is there. A desire to hear the Bhagavatam, that's the main qualification. So yes, that's true. On the other hand, the Guru and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu are Patita Pavana, they presented, Prabhupada was having us distribute, still going on, to everyone, because it's so valuable and it's so powerful. So we can cut through even the resistance. Even the jiva's resistance can be penetrated by the power of the Bhagavatam. Because Krishna is appearing, it's darshan. When you see Bhagavatam, you're getting darshan of Krishna. So that whole side of it is there. But there's also the side that, you know, the Bible says you shouldn't cast pearls before swine. So there's also the side of it that, well, we don't want to present Krishna's leela. It's so precious. Krishna's leela is so precious, we shouldn't just show it to everyone. They shouldn't be allowed in to see these things. But the devotee, the preacher, it's so that the desire is so strong to connect the wayward jivas with Krishna that they bring Krishna forward. And of course Krishna, he agrees to do it. He allows himself to be a seen. He gives darshan. Ultimately, it's Krishna who is allowing the darshan. So it's sort of, you know, it's above and beyond. It's above and beyond. It's like breaking the rules out of mercy. Audarya, it's like Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he broke the rules out of mercy. Mercy is overpowering, can be overpowering. Even in the Lord's own heart, can be overpowering, where he gives himself completely. So that can be part of the explanation of why the Bhagavatam is available, and Narada wanted it to be made available to everyone. Even though in principle you can say, well, not everyone deserves to see it. But because his desire is so strong for people to connect with Krishna, he's instructing Vyasadeva in that way. Okay, let's stop. It's 9 o'clock.